Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This time, Christopher Hitchens. William Grimes, writing in the New York Times, described Christopher Hitchens as a slashing polemicist in the tradition of Thomas Paine and George Orwell, who trained his sights on targets as various as Henry Kissinger, the British monarchy, and Mother Teresa, who wrote a bestseller attacking religious belief and dismayed his former comrades on the left by enthusiastically supporting the American-led war in Iraq. Hitchens was born in the UK and attended Oxford University. After graduating, he worked in London as a journalist, where he became immersed in leftist politics and eventually became part of a close circle of English writers that included Martin Amis, Salman Rushdie, and Ian McEwan. A lauded contrarian who thrived in public debates, he was possibly the definition of a public intellectual. Incisive, ironic, hilarious, and always original, Hitchens is the author of the books The Monarchy, A Critique of Britain's Favorite Fetish, The Missionary Position, Mother Teresa in Theory and Practice, and No One Left to Lie to, The Values of the Worst Family, about Bill Clinton following the Monica Lewinsky affair. Hitchens is perhaps best known for his 2008 book God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. It was a finalist for the National Book Award. Here's Christopher Hitchens speaking in Portland in 2010, one of his very last lectures before he passed away a little more than a year later. His talk was part of Portland Arts and Lectures in front of a live audience at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, very much for coming out tonight. For giving me something uncomfortably like a cathedral pulpit in which to speak, and for supplying the climatic conditions of my youth. Whoever says Oregonian hospitality isn't the real thing hasn't tried it. Everyone knows what the subject is this evening, and everyone, or everything, I mean to say, sort of conspires with me, whether I want them to or not, to make the subject more relevant. And I thought I'd begin by applying a sort of Rorschach test, a question or two, to you from recent developments that will be familiar. Here's your moral Rorschach test. On New Year's Eve, a man aged 75 years old, alone, unmarried, unescorted, is having a sleepover with his five-year-old granddaughter. And suddenly an axe is taken to the outside of his front door, which is successfully broken into, with a man still wielding an axe and a knife. And if the 75-year-old man hadn't had the presence of mind to get his granddaughter very quickly inside a locked bathroom and lock it behind him, whereupon that door began to splinter as well and actuate a panic call to the police, he and she would have been hacked to pieces as the last year turned. Now, I'm assuming everyone here is of average moral character, let's say. What's your reaction when you hear about a thing like that? You think, well, there is such a thing as evil in the world. There are good people, and there are bad people, and the good people do good things, or at least they do the best they do, and the bad people seem to rather enjoy doing things that in our worst nightmares we wouldn't want to do, or if we were found guilty of doing, would almost want to die. To hack a five-year-old girl into pieces in front of her grandfather before killing him, or maybe, who knows, the grandfather in front of the little girl first. Simple, you might think, as many moral questions essentially are. I read yesterday an article in The Guardian of London. It used to be called The Manchester Guardian. Probably one of the most famous liberal daily newspapers in the world, certainly in the English-speaking world. Long article by an academic saying, no, don't look at this picture like that. It's not a Rorschach test at all. What you need to understand is that this old man, grandfather to that girl, once drew a cartoon that very gravely upset some believers in a religion I won't have to mention to you, I don't have to identify it. But was the religion professed by the man who thought New Year's Eve would be a good time to break in with an axe and try and kill them both? Surely the fault here is with the man who drew those cartoons. If he hadn't done that, this crime wouldn't have occurred. Just revolve this thought in your mind for a second. It's not the only instance I have for you. Not very long ago, in a base, a United States Army base, in fact, in the state of Texas, a man who'd taken a Hippocratic oath, a physician, in fact, a physician in training, unshipped his weapon, actually not his weapon, but a private weapon he'd bought off the base, and sprayed people who were waiting for a medical examination with lethal fire, killing them in some number, after having shouted a very well-known religious slogan. There's no need to mention which monotheism he was affiliated with. Actually, I get ahead of myself when I say he shouted a slogan. What if he hadn't? Would if he had kept quiet about his faith, would the President of the United States have said, and the New York Times have said, and CNN have said, this appears to be something it's too early to pass judgment upon. Let's not rush to a conclusion. Let's consider the influence of post, in fact, in this man's case, pre-traumatic stress disorder, since he hadn't actually experienced any warfare, yet was trying to, was ostensibly helping other caregivers to help people who do suffer from it. No, I don't think that if you'd left out the religious question, that anyone would have found any reason to euphemize, to otherwise characterize, to relativize, to try and minimize, to diminish the full effect of the atrocity that was confronted right in front of our eyes. I have a couple of other examples of this sort, ladies and gentlemen, but I have a feeling, brothers and sisters, that you know what I mean. And it's not for its own innate interest alone that I mention these examples. It's for this reason. I must have debated now in several hundred religious venues as the guest of every kind of religious institution, university, private group, public church. And I have never not been confronted with the argument that without a belief in a one God and a creator and a religiously dictated code of ethics and morals, I myself would not know right from wrong. Without heavenly authority, without the mandate and warrant that comes from a celestial dictatorship, as I think of it myself, a sort of North Korea with more clouds, and a dear leader and a great leader and just one short of a trinity, at least you can die and leave North Korea, whereas when you die with the faithful, that's when the fun really begins. But I actually almost deliberately digress. That I, born in the same way as you were, with roughly the same, so to speak, morally innate instincts, wouldn't be able to trust them, would not be able to guess myself what was right from wrong. I would be sunk in a mere swamp of modernism, relativism, hedonism. I would have no true north to which my compass could turn without the divine to know what was a wicked or iniquitous action. Well, I just return you now to the two examples that I was able to pick easily just from today's headlines and say to you, who is relativizing evil here? Who's making the excuses? Who's saying, well, once you know that they're people of faith, you must make allowances for the horrific crimes they commit and the terrible cruelty that they advance? Who here is being, if you like, soft on crime? Is it not, in fact, in reverse the case that it is not without God that all is possible, as Dostoevsky once rather brilliantly put it in The Brothers Karamazov, but that it is with God that someone who feels that once they're on a divine mission, anything is permitted to them, and of course to nobody else? And what is this but the most abject, slimy, euphemistic, obviously man-made moral relativism? So to the main point that my antagonists make against me, I have, at least in opening, this reply. And I'd urge you to try and keep it in mind the next time you hear it yourself. How dare people who issue warrants for murder and torture of other humans say that without God, people would behave worse. I have evolved an equally simple question, because many of these questions are, in fact, deceptively easy, to that same reply, rather to that same challenge. I've replied to it with a challenge of my own. I'd like to meet, I haven't yet met in all these debates, a spokesman for faith who will say to me, here is a moral statement made, or moral ethical action undertaken by a believer, that you, Hitchens, or one of your co-thinkers, couldn't, as an unbeliever, make. You couldn't duplicate it. I've never yet had a reply to it. I have, in thought experiments, thought of one such example, and if you press me very hard in the question time, I'll tell you what it is. But it's it doesn't solve the problem of relativism. Now, so that challenge, which I've now issued to quite senior theologians and men of God in holy orders, I've not yet had a reply, and I consider it significant that an amateur like myself can defeat professionals of that sort with such an obvious question. But remember, religion is supposed to be for the humble, for the simple. It's supposed to be obvious. It's supposed to be morally self-evident. It's supposed to be a matter of faith. If I can baffle them like that, how good is their casuistry and sophistication? Pressing on and getting a bit cruder, I have a corollary to my challenge, which is, can you think of an evil action performed by a religious person or wicked statement made because of their faith? And everyone immediately has thought of one. You all have, haven't you? And if you think again for a second, you'll be able to think of another. The suicide murder community is more or less exclusively faith-based. Not entirely, I won't say that, but more or less exclusively faith-based. The genital mutilation community, I regret to tell you, is faith-based by definition. The child abuse community, no, let's not say that there's a sin, an iniquitous one that most of us really would rather die than even be suspected of, is, of course, part of the proof that we are not all made in the image of God, because we are a poorly evolved primate species and we're capable of appalling cruelty to our offspring. But it's very rare that such a thing is institutionalized over generations and made into something where senior prelates of a church that believes in mortal sin and undying punishment will regularly subject themselves and protect their colleagues from the consequences of a vileness that is almost unimaginable. It proves to me they can't really mean what they say. Jesus of Nazareth says one moral thing for sure, which is rather than harm a child, you should rather be drowned in infinite water with a millstone around your neck. It's been the profession. It's been an institutional crisis for a major church. I vulgarly say in my book, their motto in Latin would read, no child's behind left, if crudely translated. This is not a venial sin, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, everyone can understand a priest who perhaps has an affair with his housekeeper, but to the rape and torture of children, which is what abuse really means, is something frighteningly evil, and it's had to be admitted as something that has run from top to bottom through a church that, of course, will excommunicate you if you're found to have used a contraceptive. That says that AIDS in Africa may be very much to be deplored, but not as much as condoms are to be deplored. This is moral relativism of a very low order. It's not even a sophisticated casuistry. It's a very crude kind. A church that never threatened any German or Austrian or Bavarian with excommunication for taking part in the final solution, the Holocaust. Not once were they threatened with excommunication for that, but they excommunicated Joseph Goebbels because he had married a divorced Protestant. Excuse me, we do have our standards. You see what I mean about the relativist problem. How dare they say to me that without their faith, I might fall into error? It's insulting to be talked to in this way, and I think it's time that we develop the fortitude to talk back to people of faith and say, why exactly do you demand respect for what you say? Why is it that but the profession of, well, I'm a person of faith, is expected to bring a smirking look of agreement onto the face of the television interviewer? Well, yes, of course, we all understand that now you've said that, you're entitled to run for office. No names, I'm not going to say. All right. Now, the Catholic Church in Ireland, I'm going to stop with the child torture and rape thing now, because I don't want you to think I'm being demagogic on this obscene question, but as it happens, in the last month or two, the Catholic Church in Ireland had to see the resignation of three, I think it was, certainly two senior archbishops, not for not reporting the stuff, the hideous stuff, but effectively for complicity with it, not for covering it up, for empowering it, for keeping it going for a long time. The Irish government's report on the subject appears to say, according to some well-qualified Irish commentators I know, that in the period covered by the investigation, it's the number of Irish children who were not subjected to abuse that are the minority. This is a very, 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 very serious moral question. So that the report, I think, was published in November. Two or three senior archbishops had to offer their resignations. Resignations? Why weren't they fired? Why aren't they on trial? Where is Cardinal Law of Boston? The man who in our own country protected and empowered and covered up this atrocity. Why is he not, as the laity of Boston demanded that he be, why is he not on trial? Because he's fled the jurisdiction and has a sinecure in the Vatican under the protection of His Holiness the Pope. He's the vicar of Santa Maria Maggiore in Rome, and voted in the College of Cardinals to pick the next pope, who is the vicar of Christ on earth. How can these people live with this kind of thing? But, as I say, I'm not going to say any more about that. But as of yesterday, I believe, a new law came into force in the Irish Parliament, the Dáil, forced through in the midst of this by a church that obviously feels itself somewhat on the defensive, that creates the new offence in Ireland of blasphemy and says you may not lampoon or abuse, there's a proper use to the word abuse, not a euphemism, you may not laugh at, you may not insult, you may not decry religious faith. Now, in Ireland, that essentially means only one, but it's hypocritically written to mean you may not attack any others either. So the response to the beginning in a European country of a proper inquiry into the horror that was allowed, the injury that was done to society and its most precious members by the fact of an established church, suddenly is blocked. Because don't even think about making too much of it. The law will say no. You may not offend the faithful. Is this not something absolutely extraordinary? I ask you. And isn't it rather sinister that it wouldn't probably have the face to succeed if it only defended the Catholic Church? But it says, no, we include all other churches too, rather defensively, protectively. All other faiths, don't try and lampoon them. So let me see if I've got this right. Religion makes a rather large claim. I mean, the debate between me and a non-believer is not really at all like a dispute between a supporter of the Democratic and Republican parties, for example. I say there's no evidence of a supernatural dimension of any kind, none. And that there's no evidence of divine intervention, none. And that the tests of it ontologically and otherwise have generally failed. That's my view. He or she says, no, we think there is evidence of the supernatural, and it would be anyway, people would behave much worse if they didn't think so and so forth. But remember, this is not a disagreement of emphasis. What is claimed by religion is the power to bind and to loose, to save or to condemn, to offer real salvation, to make the promise of paradise or the threat of hell. A great deal rests on it. The religious are claiming to know more than, in my opinion, any primate can, or mammal, can possibly know. I don't admit the right of any other human being to have access to supernatural information that's denied to me. Clever as they may be, or stupid as they sometimes are. I don't admit that they have access to privileged information about the cosmos, and they've never been able to suggest that they do. But remember the large claim they make. Now, extraordinary claims, it seems to me, I'm being as reasonable as I'm going to be all evening, extraordinary claims demand extraordinary evidence. What do these extraordinary claims have to back them? Nothing. Nothing but assertion and the implied threat that if you don't believe in it, we'll kill you. Which is a backup of a kind. Or in other ways, make your life extremely unpleasant. And where we can, we'll legislate to prevent you from writing an article, publishing a novel, writing a book of nonfiction, or otherwise getting in our way. Now, this is totalitarianism, in my opinion. This is the claim not just to power... Oh, thank you. A bit faint, but it was a start. Yeah. I'll take scattered applause, if you like. It's totalitarian by definition because it says the faith, this is a faith that has to be absolute. In a world which we now know in all our studies of physics and biology and cosmology is governed by various principles of very radical uncertainty. No, only believe. Be sure, be certain. We already have all the information we want. We don't really need any more books. We'll grudgingly sometimes look at some of them and say, these appear to confirm what we said all along. But in essence, it's a dogma. But it may not be criticized. That is precisely the message of modern totalitarianism and ancient absolutist theocracy as well. And now it's armed and dangerous and getting onto our airplanes and killing, or trying to kill, elderly cartoonists and their granddaughters in Denmark. So nice as Portland is, and remote as it may seem from some of these atrocities, don't you worry, all this is coming to a place near you.
You're listening to a talk by Christopher Hitchens. He spoke as part of Portland Arts and Lectures in 2010. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project, and more with Hitchens is coming up.
My feeling of the totalitarian leads me to my next point. I'm sometimes grouped with a tendency or faction. I don't know quite how to call it. It's an informal assembly of people anyway called the New Atheists. There's nothing particularly new about what we say. The inclusion of myself in this list of names is exorbitantly flattering to myself because Professors Richard Dawkins and Daniel Dennett and Dr. Samuel Harris are respectively very renowned biologists, philosophers, neurologists, philosophers of science, and so forth. And I'm a mere Ingersollian amateur in this, and if there weren't four of us, we wouldn't be called the Four Horsemen, because well, you know what cliche is like in this. But I will, in the time that's remaining to me, because I want to divide our time in such a way as that I still do most of the talking, but that we have a Q&A session. I just thought I'd say what the challenges to this totalitarian worldview are, what I've learned from the recent advances in scientific endeavor, that it seemed to me make the claim of religion to be unassailable and uncriticizable both laughable and sinister. Every second I've been speaking, every single second, and every second since the first moments of the Big Bang, every second, mark you, your brain isn't big enough really for this, but you can try. Neither is mine big enough. You can try. A sun, a star like ours, blows up. That's the way it is, and that's the way it's always been. And so that's quite a lot of suns gone while I've just been driveling on here. How this goes with an argument from design, I'm never quite sure. Let's localize it a bit. That's too much for any of us to really speculate about. We can localize it a little bit. When Edwin Hubble, I owe this point to Lawrence Krauss, who I think is the best physicist currently writing on these matters. It used to be thought, yes, we can detect the Big Bang from the red light shift. We can. We can see it. It's still going on around us. But surely the rate of the expansion of the universe from this original amazing explosion will slow down. Newtonianism seems to suggest it. It'll go on flying away from itself, but the rate will decrease. Well, Edwin Hubble first pointed out that it was increasing. But then it was thought, well, even so, it'll slow down. And Lawrence Krauss pointed out, no, it's getting, actually, the rate is accelerating still. So that we're quite lucky to have taken the bearings on the cosmos that we have done in the last few decades. If we'd waited another few tens of thousands of years, probably the evidence wouldn't have been so easy to see. It's moving apart so fast. And those of you interested in global warming may be intrigued to know that the luminosity of the sun is increasing at a very rapid rate meanwhile, and that in measurable time, the surface of the world, whatever we do about it, will become the same temperature as Venus now is. And there are physicists actually working on the possibility of moving Earth into a different orbit. I don't joke. This is a serious conversation. Because otherwise we're surely done for. So, of course, the religious people are right in saying that everything proves they were right all along, because, yes, the end of the world is at hand. And if you look in the night sky, you can see the Andromeda galaxy heading towards us. It's absolutely on collision course for our galaxy. But our sun will have swollen up, and our Earth will have boiled up and dried and gone to a crisp long before that happens. So you can scratch that from your list of New Year things to worry about. But am I alone in thinking that if we'd known all of this when it was first proposed to us, that God had intervened in Palestine 2,000 years ago, if we'd been the possessors of this information then, we wouldn't have been quite so impressed by it. I'll put it another way, just moving to our little suburb, our species has been on the planet for, let's say, at least 100,000 years. Some people say 150. There's a dispute. Francis Collins, the great Christian scientist, scientific Christian, I'm sorry, he's not a Christian scientist. Christian, who's also a scientist, who did the Human Genome Project, reckons at least 100,000 years. I'll give him that. Don't need any more. So you have to picture this. For 100,000 years, the human species is alive. 99.8% of all other species have died, that ever were on the planet, died, gone, leaving no descendants, extinct. Our species makes a late appearance in Africa, very nearly gets wiped out then, manages to expand. 100,000 years of struggle and fear, life expectancy perhaps 25 years, dying of their teeth, terrified of comets, volcanoes, tsunamis, storms, eclipses, no idea of what's happening, no germ theory of disease, and added to that, endless war with other human tribes. Pretty grim, a lot of suffering, a lot of misery, a lot of ignorance, a lot of terror. But heaven, the creator, manages to look with folded arms on this. They don't seem to be doing that well. I'm glad I'm not one of them. Especially not her. Dying in childbirth at that epoch would not be pretty. It shouldn't happen to anybody. The kid will die too. But then, a change of plan around 3,000 years ago, after 97,000 years, let's call it, of indifference, time to intervene. But not in, where should we show ourselves? Well, not in China. They can read there. They've actually managed to do quite a lot better than most of the other primates. No, not China. Not the Indus Valley. Not even Mesopotamia, where quite a lot is going on. They've learned to brew beer for us, just to dull the pain of God's attention. No, in the most Stone Age horror show, the most terrified, ignorant, illiterate peasantry of the lot, we'll show ourselves to them. Now, I submit that if you'd known anything about ethnology and anthropology before these myths began to circulate, there isn't a chance of them being accepted. Once you reverse engineer it, which they would like to do in reverse, they're going to say, now we know about Darwin, we think God is even cleverer than we used to say when we thought Darwin should be banned. Because evolution just shows how clever God is after all. Same with the Big Bang. No, you can't take it back having pretended it wasn't there or having tried to ban its teaching. But suppose you don't do reverse engineering, you enlighten yourself about the past. What chance is there of accepting the Bethlehem myth? Or the idea that a sixth century, Arab illiterate merchant receives instructions from the archangel Gabriel, which cannot later be challenged, or that Moses can part water to lead his stricken people to the one part of the Middle East where there's no oil. Well chosen. I can submit in all seriousness that if we had known any of these things, and we haven't known all of them for very long, and some of them we haven't known at all, only discovered in the last 150 or so years, it would be quite impossible for anyone to come to your door and say, have you heard the good news about, as it might be, Joseph Smith, fastest growing Christian religion in the world, an outright abject, obvious fraud and racket. So I asked someone to show me when I'd gone too far, but if no one has... I sometimes also think if you ever worry you've gone too far, it means you haven't yet gone far enough. If you hadn't got my main point by now, I have a feeling you might not be going to get it. So, in the light of this, it seems to me sinister, as I said, and laughable, as I also said, to allow the claims of religion as metaphysics, I mean, to respect them metaphysically. I mean, a great man, Stephen Jay Gould, who I'm sure many of you have read, one of the great evolutionary biologists, proposed a compromise in the same way as T.H. Huxley, Darwin's great deputy in debate, proposed a compromise. T.H. Huxley, who I very much admired, who in his debate with Bishop Wilberforce in Oxford did for Europe what the later debate between William Jennings Bryan and H.L. Mencken and Clarence Darrow did in the Tennessee Scopes trial 50 years later, and simply laid low the church's belief that God had put the fossils in the rocks to test our faith and so forth. But did propose the compromise of the word agnostic. It comes from Huxley, as to those who can't decide or feel that one should remain undecided. In something of the same way, Stephen Jay Gould used to say that, before his early, much too early, regrettable death, that religion and science were non-overlapping magisteria, as he put it. I don't think this kind of compromise is really any longer thinkable. To say you are an agnostic is to say that you have no belief. Not that you are an atheist, but you have no belief in God. If you have no belief in God, then you might as well say that that's what you don't have. It seems to be cowardly to lurk in the into and say, well, it could be true, but I just don't know. If you don't know, the religious will tell you, you don't believe. And they're right, I think, to be strict on the point. Of those of little faith, they have no patience, and neither do I. On the possibility that the magisteria could overlap, I think I've done, as a real amateur, someone who is terrified that at the thought of my scientific colleagues listening to my puerile explanation of the extraordinary work that they've done, but the extrapolations I've made, partly with their permission, from it, it isn't really possible. If you had known all the things I was talking about, you cannot no longer believe that the world or its design or its humanity or its speciation, it's amazing, actually rather beautiful, actually rather miraculous reality is compatible with the supernatural or the superstitious. Everything we're made of, cheer up, we're not just materialists here, everything we're made of is stardust. You don't have to despair and become a bored old morose materialist. You still have irony. You still have music, love, sex, landscape, Chinese food, philosophy, which is much more consoling than mere incantation. And you still have the sense of wonder that comes from the extraordinary beauty and symmetry of the universe and the wonderful kinship that we're beginning to find out that we also have through our genome with other creatures. And by the way, the interesting responsibilities and reflections that arise from knowing that we're made out of the same material. But for the idea that we are not allowed to know any of this without divine permission, that it only comes to us as a gift, that we are mere passive recipients of wisdom, and that without submission to this celestial dictatorship, we wouldn't even know how to behave well to one another, I think it's time to go a bit beyond ridicule and beyond indignation and to say very staunchly that we will resist that and that we will enforce and protect our constitution and its patrolling of the frontier between church and state and its liberty of conscience and its long record of people who've been willing to die to uphold that, as I try and put it, Mr. Jefferson, on that wall of separation, build up that wall. And to reply and to reply to those who want to bring their ideologies of medieval cruelty and stupidity at gunpoint and with violence into our own homes, into our civil aviation. No, we will resist, we will fight you, and don't get this wrong. We too have real principles and unalterable convictions, and these we will maintain. Thank you. Well, now, you might think it's invidious that I get to pick to weed the questions. But at least it means I haven't planted anyone in the audience. And I can also get rid of the boring and mad ones. Actually, why would I do that? It's an argument about religion. Okay, well, you've been very sparing, ladies and gentlemen, or someone's weeded them before. I will just take them in order. Which is more satisfying, writing about politics or writing about literature? Emphatically, the latter, partly because, and it goes to the point I was trying to make before, I don't think that morality and ethics are to be found in the holy books, partly because in those books so many things are recommended that are wicked, evil. It's not that you have to rely for your own morality on a God figure. That would be bad enough, abject enough. It's that if you do accept the instructions, then Moses will tell you to go and destroy all the children of the neighboring tribe. For example, take their land, enslave their women for purposes better imagined than described, and so forth, or to mutilate your children, or to immolate, or to burn witches, for example. I mean, all of these injunctions, divine injunctions, are in the books. Whereas, if you read George Eliot, for example, in particular, I think, Middlemarch, Felix Holt, The Mill on the Floss, there's more, and some of her translations of German philosophy into English. there's a great deal more reflection, hard but enlightening and encouraging of a humanistic kind, to be found in the contemplation of that. And bear this in mind for the education of your children, than there is in the scrutiny of severe, ancient, contradictory Stone Age texts. So one of the reasons I think why it's much more interesting to debate Dostoevsky, that is Leviticus, for example, does proceed from the study of literature. Of course, it should be said that religion gave us our first texts and accustomed us to textual criticism, and that's to its credit in a way. We owe them that much, but it's regrettable that very often they say those texts aren't really available for anything but repetition. They're not to be scrutinized. They're not to be unpacked. Literature doesn't subject you to that terrible inhibition. So I'd far rather be writing about literature than about politics, but politics won't leave me alone. Or you, either. I mean, by the end of the last century, I'd increasingly tried to move away from writing political polemics. And I was trying to write a book about Marcel Proust, if that doesn't make you laugh. But always in my mind was the realization that my friend Salman Rushdie had told me one day, a few years before, he thought it would be interesting to write a book that took Holy Writ as if it was literary text, and in particular to examine those very odd verses of the Quran that Muslims say are so wrong that they must have been dictated not by the archangel but by the devil, the so-called satanic verses. How interesting it would be to write a novel on that theme. Yeah, well, so it proved. And it's a regrettable fact, but it's the case that that novel, though it and its author did survive a huge campaign of defamation and violence, no publisher would now publish a novel along those lines by any other author, even someone as eminent as Salman. And we all now live in the climate of self-censorship, exemplified by the Danish case and others, that's been imposed on us. And that's not just a literary question, but also a political one. So anyway, to the extent that the distinction can be made, give me literature every time. What do you think of the question on the front of last month's Atlantic Monthly? Ah, there's more. Did Christianity cause the crash? No. Capitalism caused the crash. Why did you send your children to Quaker school? My youngest daughter goes to school at Sidwell Friends in Washington, where the president's children go and the vice president's granddaughter goes. Until recently, I would have thought that meant she was safe, at least during the day. But now that all you need to get on an airplane is a certificate saying that you're on a terrorist watch list, or now that anyone could go to the White House to dinner without an invitation, I'm really not so sure. As for Quakerism, well, it was the religion of Richard Nixon. and it immorally preaches a non-resistance to evil, but they do have a respect for education, I must say. Anyway, I don't send anyone anywhere, but some of my children are smart enough to go where they want to go. And if it wasn't for me, none of my children would know anything about religion, by the way, because so gun-shy is the American system now that very few people in school are even taught, say, something as wonderful as literature, as the King James authorized version of the Bible, even as something beautiful to read. So that anyone who wants to know what I'm arguing about will often have to have me tell them what it actually is. And this, I think, is a big sign of cultural desertification, I have to say. If Karen Armstrong were willing, would you debate her? Yes. There's no one I've ever refused to debate. I suppose I have to do this one. Yes, I must. You support war in Iraq, yet condemn the attack on the military base in Texas. How is this different from U.S. military or Blackwater attacks killing Iraqi civilians? It's well known that the U.S. military is filled with fundamentalist Christians. Are we justified in killing 500,000 Muslim civilians because we have uniforms? Well, I don't think that the United States Army or even its most fundamentalist preachers, to take the question at its strongest, train or encourage their soldiers to get as close as they can to a group of people waiting for vaccinations and spray them unarmed in the back. I don't think that is the way our troops are instructed. In fact, very often American soldiers are required to endanger themselves and to take risks to their own personal safety rather than endanger what might be a civilian target. I also think that you make a mistake when you say 500,000 Muslim civilians, two kinds of mistake. I don't think there's any evidence at all that 500,000 people have been killed in the wars altogether in Afghanistan and Iraq, but to the extent that hundreds of thousands of people have been killed, it's by the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and their allies, whose victims are mainly Muslim. That I would take as an axiom. And second, I think it's entirely wrong to describe these as Muslim countries. I mean, if you're going to get, as the New York Times suddenly does, sometimes does, people saying Major Hassan was worried about American troops on Muslim soil, are you going to say that France and England belong to Christendom? Wouldn't you write into the New York Times if they said that? I hope you would. What about Jewish soil? Does such a concept exist? I'm not sure. Muslim soil, we let them get away with. Now, I'm sorry, Iraq was Christian, and Mesopotamia was Christian, and the buildings and the architecture show it long before the birth of Islam. And there are still millions of Christians there to prove it, though they're being diminished in horrible ways by terrible persecution, as were the Christians of Afghanistan, as were the dissident Muslims in Afghanistan and Iraq. If you're the wrong kind of Muslim, you're easy prey. You're announced as fit for slaughter by the pious. Who doesn't know this? I'm sorry, I don't feel like saying that men and women are the moral equivalent of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, and I'm not very interested in hearing from people who do. So, and I bet you wouldn't dare say it to their face either. So that's that. And I'm really against denominating land as religious. That's the beginning of wickedness. The whole problem with the Old Testament in the first place is that it says that some land belongs to you and you can kill in my name anyone else who happens to be living or working there. That's the fons et origo, the radix malorum. Anyone who talks like that or allows themselves to talk like that is playing into the hands of barbaric theocratic propaganda. Have nothing to do with it. Stay well away from it. Don't echo it. Be glad you live in a country that lets you do so, however. One more. Well, then I better be careful. Let's get the best. Okay, quickly. Are the priests refusing communion to politicians who support abortion rights trying to influence their vote or banish the politician? I think the Catholic Church is well within its rights to excommunicate people who don't follow its precepts. You don't have to be a Catholic. It's a voluntary association. It has certain dogmas, some of which are, in my opinion, quite admirable, such as the defense of the idea of the unborn child. It's probably the only real principled question that the Church has left. If one of its elected politicians compromises on that point, I think that the Church doesn't influence Congress by saying, you can vote that way, but you can't come to communion. They're well within their rights to do so. It's self-pitying, and I think the politician should decide what kind of moral courage they have, which is the position I really want to take. Do I want to be a member of a church that can tell me what to do on matters of faith and morals, which has an infallible leader in His Holiness the Pope, or would I rather think for myself and represent my voters? Well, I think they should be forced to make the second choice, but I don't mind the church helping them to do so. Right? If you're dying and the only person left on earth who can cure you is a Christian who wants to pray for you before operating on you, would you let him or her? Yes. Interesting, by the way, that in Washington, my hometown, recently, the Catholic Church has said they won't take part in the social services and charity stuff anymore if the city carries on with its gay rights legislation. So you get, again, a sense that it isn't all done just for the love of humanity. I think they're coming to take me away. It's been real, thank you.
That was Christopher Hitchens speaking at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in Portland in 2010. Hitchens wrote scathing critiques of public figures and was well known on news shows as a debater and instigator. He was a finalist for the National Book Award in 2008 for his book God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear this or any of the other talks in the series, visit literary-arts.org. Spencer Rimmon produces the Archive Project for radio. I'm Andrew Proctor. Thanks for joining us.